there's about 830 million people in the world who are food insecure. They don't get enough to eat every day. But there's about 2 billion people that have micronutrient deficiencies. As there's more carbon in the plant, there's less nitrogen. And that means about a 10% reduction in protein. B vitamins can fall by as much as 30% under carbon dioxide concentrations expected later in the century. And these could have impacts on hundreds of millions of people around the world.
It's time for conversations about our food and how it's grown on Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson.
Climate change is on a lot of people's minds and for many reasons, and I'm going to give away the time of the year that we're actually recording this because it happens to be a week that we're supposed to make official that the United States is out of the Paris Climate Accord. And there's all kinds of drama around that decision, including whether or not it would stand at all. But it just seems like it's a particularly good time to talk about the effects of climate change. And you know, there's a lot of implications of even the politics of climate change. But climate change has some effects that we haven't even been talking about, and that's what brought me to our guest today. And I want to welcome Dr. Christy Ebi. Christy, welcome to Farm to Table Talk.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me.
You know, Christy, I got onto a webinar, I guess it was, about climate change, and I thought I have like heard everything. But you had several things that you were mentioning that I hadn't really heard anybody bringing up before. And that's what got my attention and why I chased you down at the University of Washington. And I think I'm chasing you down this morning at having recently found a place to walk for a cup of coffee. And I'm just jealous that I couldn't walk with you to have a cup of coffee because those are the best kinds of conversations. Maybe we'll do it someday.
Someday would be great. I'd enjoy that. Thank you.
Well, and you know, and when I saw your presentation, I looked up some things that you had online, and then I found you've done some other presentations. You've done TED Talks. You've got some presentations on YouTube. And so in addition to people joining us in our conversation this morning, they ought to also check out some of what you have online as well. And go visit YouTube and see some of what you've talked about. Let's establish where you are and what your primary responsibilities. You're at the University of Washington, and you're in the middle of talking about all of these issues right now. Would you explain that? Explain what your responsibilities are at the University of Washington and what finds you in the middle of all these conversations about climate change?
Thank you very much. I really appreciate being involved in this discussion, and it would be great to be doing it in person. I've been working on the health risk of a changing climate for almost 25 years. I joined the University of Washington about 6 years ago to establish the Center for Health and the Global Environment. And we have a research team now that looks at a broad range of the health risk of a changing climate. We also look at the kinds of responses that can be made by individuals, organizations, departments of health, and others to prepare for and manage those risks. And we estimate the health co-benefits of mitigation policies and technologies. So in a nutshell, those are the range of activities we engage in.
Are you teaching classes and conducting research?
Yes, I teach two classes on global environmental change and health, and as most faculty in schools of public health, we're on soft money, so it is our responsibility to bring in sufficient funding to cover our research.
You know, even though you say you've been doing this for 25 years, that's kind of almost the beginning, really. I mean, for discussions, that climate change was starting to be talked about. I'm curious that when you started your studies and started working towards what your eventual PhD would be, I would guess you didn't expect that you were going to be spending so much time on climate change when you were a student. Would I guess right?
You are right. This was close to the beginning of when the issue started. The issue was started by Professor Tony McMichael, and one of the people in the small group that was working on the health risk of a changing climate. One liked to say that all of us could have met in a phone booth. It was pretty small. We still know each other very well, and we still have wonderful opportunities to collaborate together.
Well, a lot of people go back and they point to the first time they heard about it was from Al Gore, who ended up putting together a fairly popular PowerPoint presentation that became a movie and books and everything else. But I assume he had to be inspired by somebody. So you're referring to one researcher. Who else was out there that, you know, pre-Al Gore?
Mr. Gore held a series of hearings in Congress, as I recall. Among the people who testified to him were Dr. Stephen Schneider and Dr. James Hansen. But Mr. Gore was interested in climate change before that because there was a reason he held the hearing. And I honestly don't know where his initial interest came from. He always interfaced with the scientific community and certainly would have come from the concerns raised by National Academy reports and others about what could happen as humans continue to put greenhouse gases into the atmosphere.
There's a good and a bad side of having a politician kind of leading these efforts. I mean, there were some people that were willing to listen to him right off the bat and thought, well, this is persuasive, and he was able to get out in front of it. And then there were some people that just resisted because they were so opposed to his politics otherwise that they just thought it couldn't be true. And, you know, I suppose that's always the case, that if you have, when the politicians are very much involved, that there are some people that will be resisting and some people say, well, I'm in. But one thing that's happened over those 25 years, Christy, is that the scientific consensus has just snowballed, if you will. And, you know, it's rare every once in a while you get to pick somebody out that says that they're a doubter. But it's down to the point that if there's two or three here or there that are mentioned out of the thousands and thousands of scientists, we're as close to a clear consensus in the scientific community as I think we can get on anything. Would that be fair to say, or am I going too far?
You're exactly right. The latest publication on this is a couple of years ago and concluded that 97 or 98% of scientists who understand issues around climate change are in agreement that humans are changing the climate. And as some of our comedians like to point out, we can't get one out of five dentists to agree on how we should brush our teeth. So the consensus is very high that humans are changing the climate, which is then affecting our health, our well-being, and our livelihood.
So there's so many ways to go in this conversation. One is to kind of build on what are the steps we can take, what can be taken as individuals and countries, and what role of science and researchers and people that are in positions like you are can play. And I want to touch on a little bit of all of those things, but I want to go to the impacts of over these next several years, and maybe 20 or 30 or 40 or so years of potential impacts of climate change. And certainly in agriculture, we see that it looks like some areas of the country are going to be able to not produce as much as what they used to. And there can be some other areas in North America that might slightly improve with the change. So there's all sorts of ramifications there. But one thing that I heard you talk about that I haven't really heard anybody else talk about is the implications of having higher carbon dioxide levels in the air having an impact on the nutritional quality of our foods. And when I heard you say that, I thought, I've been around these conversations so much, maybe I just wasn't paying attention, but you're the only one that I really can think of that's articulated that fact so well. Could you explain that? I mean, how did you even discover it? And explain that to others that are hearing this maybe for the first time too, that the carbon in the atmosphere can have an effect of reduction of some of the nutritional benefits of the food we grow.
Well, thank you. This is a really important question, and I'm glad that you posed it. I have the privilege of collaborating with people like Dr. Irakli Lalazi and Louis Ziska, who've been working on this issue for a number of years, and they brought me into this collaboration, which has opened my eyes to an issue I also, at the time, was not aware of. I assume everybody's heard that carbon dioxide is plant food, that many of our plants grow faster under higher concentrations of carbon dioxide. But people haven't talked about what this means in terms of the plant physiology and what then it means for our health and our nutrition. When plants have more carbon in them, they reallocate the carbon in ways that have fundamental shifts important for us. And there's two main threads in this. One is that the plant just takes up less moisture from the soil. The plant is more water efficient. It doesn't need as much water. And it reallocates, as I said, the carbon between the plant and the rootstock. The consequences of those changes are that the plants absorb fewer micronutrients. When you look at field studies that have been done under higher concentrations of carbon dioxide, there is about a 10% reduction, 5 to 10% reduction in many of the micronutrients. And that is really important when you think about iron, for example. There's about 830 million people in the world who are food insecure. They don't get enough to eat every day. But there's about 2 billion people that have micronutrient deficiencies. There's over 1.5 million women and girls who are deficient in iron. And that is critically important. Not enough zinc can lead to stunting. So it's really important to understand what's happening with these changes in the micronutrients. The second pathway is that as there's more carbon in the plant, there's less nitrogen. And that means about a 10% reduction in protein. And some studies that we were involved in, B vitamins can fall by as much as 30% under carbon dioxide concentrations expected later in the century. And these could have impacts on hundreds of millions of people around the world. So thank you for asking.
It's fascinating. So just the fact that the carbon levels in the air we breathe and what the plants breathe as well will be having an impact on having, you know, these lower levels of zinc and B12 and iron and so forth, which has huge consequences across the globe. These aren't easily made up for people that can afford to just take multiple vitamins. I mean, again, I don't want to, you know, make too little of this, but I do want to understand too that you don't fix that problem simply by trying to pass out multiple vitamins to a couple billion people that are otherwise going to be finding that they're not getting those nutrients.
You're exactly right. And when you look around the world, people focus on some countries like China that are fundamentally changing their diets. But there's other countries like Bangladesh, where even today, 7 of 10 calories comes from rice. And thinking about how to increase dietary diversity, particularly amongst the poor, is a very big challenge. And if handing out pills was so effective, we wouldn't see so many women and girls with iron deficiency anemia. So there does need to be a holistic response, looking at a range of possible options.
Well, and you mentioned stunting, too, for children, and that can be both a physical and mental issue for, as I understand it, I mean, thousands, I don't know if millions, maybe millions, and that's pretty frightening.
Yeah, You're exactly right. There are millions of children every year who chronically don't get enough to eat, and that leads to stunting. And it's not just that they're short. It also means that, as you said, they often have less development in the brain. It affects lifelong learning. It affects lifelong opportunities for gainful employment. It has all kinds of consequences across the life course, and it is critically important. It's one of the reasons it's one of the main focuses of the Sustainable Development Goals.
Yeah, I think right on cue, we're hearing some children's voices in your background there too. So they come on stage just at the time we start talking about children. So well planned there. The thing I wonder about is trying to think about the air and trying to think about, again, something like global warming, climate change, and the mix of carbon dioxide. When I heard you on YouTube, you've actually done some research, I believe, where you were able to add carbon dioxide to a field. That just seems incredible that that's even possible. Do you have a greenhouse or something like that that you could change the mixture of the air to be higher carbon dioxide levels to see what effects it would have?
These are called free air carbon dioxide exchange experiments. And basically, you take a field, you divide it into plots, and it's moderately sophisticated equipment where you put tubing around a plot and you blow carbon dioxide over it. So you're controlling for water, you're controlling for sunshine. All of the plots, to the extent possible, are exactly the same. And then you just set up this apparatus that you obviously have to maintain and you have to calibrate, and you make sure that there's a constant higher concentration of carbon dioxide.
Now, but is it enclosed? Did I miss that part? I mean, is it covered like with a tunnels or greenhouse or something?
No, these are open air fields.
Oh,
they also do it in trees.
So if that's the case, then are there different areas that have different mixtures of carbon dioxide? I mean, I tend to feel like the air goes everywhere in the world, but what you're talking about makes me feel like if I'm in the middle of a rainforest, I may have kind of more oxygen and lower carbon dioxide because they're absorbing more than if I'm in the desert. Is that true at all?
Carbon dioxide is an interesting molecule. It's different from the molecules that people think about when they think about air pollution. And so each molecule of carbon dioxide being emitted now, I live in the state of Washington, we don't emit much because most of our electricity is generated by renewable energy. But imagine somebody turning on a light switch and their electricity is run by a coal-fired power plant. So there's carbon dioxide emissions. And within a year, less than a year, that carbon dioxide molecule is a global molecule. It goes everywhere. There are observatories. There's one in Hawaii that is well above the cities in Hawaii, and it measures carbon dioxide in the atmosphere on a daily, weekly basis. And they publish their findings. And so you can see the increase in carbon dioxide on a global scale. You're right, if you go stand in a forest and the forest has absorbed some of that carbon dioxide, that you would experience less at that moment. But when you left the forest, then you'd be back experiencing higher levels of carbon dioxide, just like our plants are.
Wow. You know, I'm thinking that when I'm doing a podcast like this and there are people listening, and I should remember they're not all going to be as fascinated as I am with this, but I just find that fascinating because we tend to think about the effect of climate change on the world. And certainly it's going to have an effect on agriculture production patterns and so forth. But what you're saying is that the mixture and how much carbon there is in regional atmospheres. Now, if I hear you right, it evens out in some time. It moves around. But if they're able to measure and look at it around the world, it's almost like looking at clouds or something globally, that some areas are going to be experienced at certain times, higher concentrations or lower concentrations than other areas?
It's been really fascinating. I'm not an expert in this area. When those measurements were first started at Mauna Loa in Hawaii, it was discovered that the atmospheric concentration of carbon dioxide has a seasonal pattern. And for that first year or two, they thought there was something wrong with their equipment. They didn't understand why carbon dioxide concentrations would increase and decrease. And that led to the discovery of plant respiration and what an impact plant respiration has on carbon dioxide concentrations. So you can see very clearly reflected in these trends that the concentrations of carbon dioxide go up in the winter and come down in the summer. You know, they come down in the spring and into the summer when plants are flowering, and they take up a lot more carbon dioxide. So it is a worthwhile area to explore because it is fascinating.
Well, if it affects plants, does it affect humans too? I mean, are we better off if we are in an atmosphere that is, say, the carbon levels of the good old days versus what we seem to be going into? Does it, I get it that it might affect my tomato plant and, you know, the nutrients in that tomato plant, but what about humans? I mean, is there any indication that we need to be at least as concerned for us as we are for our vegetables?
At the moment, it appears the concentrations of carbon dioxide, even the much higher ones we have now, are not likely directly affecting our health. As those concentrations continue to increase at a doubling of carbon dioxide over pre-industrial, there's questions about whether that could start affecting our health. It's an area where a lot more needs to be known. It is a challenge, though, to try and project what could happen, because obviously it's unethical to put people in chambers where they constantly breathe higher carbon dioxide levels.
But you know, one thing it seems like from an experimental standpoint, you really could create an atmosphere like the giant greenhouse kind of domes or something that are pretty, where you really control all the atmosphere. And as a result of what you're growing in that environment over a period of time, you should be able to produce whatever you're producing that would be maybe higher levels of iron and zinc and vitamin K or B12 and whatever than might be readily available at the local supermarket.
It is something that people are discussing of what are the options. Can you do biofortification, for example? Can you set up situations where the crops do absorb more, even under higher CO2? Can you alter the soil? Can you alter something about the growing conditions? It's an area where significant research investment is needed, because at the rate we're admitting carbon dioxide to the atmosphere and the very long time it takes for it to come to equilibrium, we're going to have to deal with this issue for some time to come.
You know, the people that are staying with us on this conversation, and they're going to say, okay, Roger, you're kind of going down a rabbit hole here. So I do want to back up, because your original premise of the many ways that climate change are going to have an impact, that you're pointing out the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere is going to be having a negative implication on the nutritional value of what we're growing. So on the one hand, the goal is to stop or slow down these climate effects. The other is, if that's going to be the case, what's the effect of that? You know, it's sort of, so what? So if these foods are have less nutritional benefits, to be able to make up the difference, if people can't get supplementation, they have to eat more of higher quality foods or something. It's, kind of looking around the corner into that world. That seems like a huge mystery of saying, okay, well, the one thing is to stop it. The other thing is to, if this is going to be the case, how do you deal with that? And how do you make up for the fact that the foods that millions of people are consuming in the world are less nutritionally dense than what they should be?
You're right. There is a multi-pronged research agenda here that we need to understand in terms of the magnitude of the potential consequences. One of the studies I was involved in just looked at rice. We looked at the poorest and most rice-dependent countries in the world and estimated by the end of the century that about 600 million people could be affected. So the numbers coming at us are incredibly large indeed. Other studies have come up with different estimates. They're all in the hundreds of millions of people being affected. So yes, reducing our emissions of carbon dioxide, looking at plant breeding on what can be done in terms of different cultivars that will be more nutritious for us under a higher CO2 climate, higher CO2 situation, and then looking at what can be done to improve dietary diversity, which is one thing for middle and high income people. It's just a completely different story for the poor and the marginalized. We've got many people in our own country who live in food deserts, who have limited access to high quality food. So there's many things that need to be addressed to put us, the rest of the world, in a situation where we are going to be able to have nutritious diets and we don't have to worry about nutritionally related diseases because of carbon dioxide.
Wow. And I used to hope that it would be as simple as just planting more forest. And at some level, it seems there was some attention to that a few years back, and not so much lately, that some countries were making a plan that they were just going to plant trees like crazy. And, you know, I know there are areas in China where there were lots of trees planted up and down the roads, and that was part of where they were claiming they were headed the right direction just by getting more trees out, let alone would also help out if they stopped building coal plants. But still, that proactive sort of get more trees in the ground, that's not really a solution, is it?
It's one of many solutions. I think it's very important to emphasize there's multiple solutions. This is not an issue where there's going to be one magic bullet that's going to solve everything. Planting trees certainly is very, very helpful. One needs to think about how the climate is changing. And will the tree you plant today be a tree that will do well under higher temperature and different precipitation patterns? The other thing that's important about trees is you also need to think about the maintenance. So right. We've seen, you know what happens when you have issues around maintenance of forests, when you've got higher temperatures, less precipitation, and the consequences for wildfires, which then, of course, release the carbon dioxide back to the atmosphere. So it is a very important component of the set of solutions that will get us to a more resilient future.
So if we pull back to the big picture again, what's the biggest challenge you see in front of us?
I will defend the rest of the world in that not every country, but most countries really understand the challenges of a changing climate, what it means for the health of their population, for the livelihoods, their security overall. And they are moving forward. The U.S. has been not moving forward very proactively in this space. We do have varying amounts of political will. And so my first and foremost desire is for people to become informed and to act on what they think is important. I often tell my students that I think the most important thing they can do is vote. Mm-hmm. That if they want to see action on climate change, you have to have politicians who are willing to act on climate change. And so making sure that people understand the kinds of challenges we're likely to face, understand that there are a range of options we can deploy to address those challenges, and making sure that we've got the political will to make it happen.
Well, you know, you're in Washington State, and I'm in California, and those are two states that have been pretty out there in front on many of these issues. The critics or the skeptics of what you might do in Washington or we would be doing in California are saying, yeah, but you're just like 0.1% or something, or less than that, of the world issue. So what you do in the state can't really make much difference because you're so small compared to what will be done by China and India and so forth. How do you deal with people that are trying to throw cold water on these actions because we're not the whole world, we're just one state?
We are just one state. Our actions count. Every action counts. The U.S. can't sell cars in China because we don't meet their emission standards. Countries are taking action. Individuals are taking action. And collectively, we can make a difference. And so everyone stepping up and doing what they are capable of will collectively make a very large change.
No doubt some of them are going to be misfiring and, you know, not quite get it right, but you just kind of keep stumbling towards what hopefully is the right direction. When you have...
You're absolutely right. Yeah. You're absolutely right. Those are really excellent points. Well, thank you for making those.
You must have students. You must have people that are working on getting their own PhD that hope to get out in the world and make a difference. Or I'm wondering what you see, say, students today compared to a couple decades ago, where your experience goes back that far, that are going out into the world. The level of commitment that they are showing for wanting to make a difference or looking forward to having a career being engaged in this particular challenge?
It's really inspiring. The students are incredibly committed to this issue. More and more students come in and want to study with our group on climate change and health. The university has got large programs in all aspects of this issue. So there's lots of students who are coming in, want to understand the issue, want to move forward, even if it's not their primary focus of their career, but they want to make sure that whatever they do in their career will contribute to sustainability. And so it is a privilege to be able to work with students and see all their energy and enthusiasm.
Well, and they probably have opportunities to apply for jobs in large corporations that are creating departments of sustainability now. Jobs that never existed before, but I think you'd be hard pressed to identify any large company anymore, let alone small companies, that isn't making some sort of a step towards more sustainable practices. Are you running into that too?
There's been a bit less of that in health because there's almost no funding for this issue in health. But certainly in other areas, there is incredible interest. And yes, there are lots of job postings. And companies, cities want people who've got some training in this area so they can contribute to the efforts that are being undertaken.
Well, I know when you go to the grocery store, it's not hard to find some packages that have some statement about what their suppliers are doing that's a step in the right direction. Get back to our original point that it might not be something sweeping that kind of changes everything, but they are taking what they believe is a step in the right direction. So I find myself heartened by that. And then I think they're going to want to hire those students that you're talking about. Say, come to work for us and we're going to walk the talk. So I have my fingers crossed that they'll stay sincere and it's not just a marketing effort.
That sounds great.
We've gone deep into an area that I think a lot of people weren't aware of, certainly I wasn't aware of the potential impact of just these higher carbon levels on the nutritional quality of the foods we're producing and all kinds of implications that will come from that. I guess that from your standpoint, what really motivates you? What are you getting excited about when you look at where you are with this issue and you planted yourself squarely within this whole climate change dynamic and the issue itself? What gets you excited?
It's a really good question. I care deeply about our future. I care deeply about the health and well-being of everybody on the planet. And am privileged to be part of a group of people working to ensure we move to more sustainable and resilient pathways. The students get me excited. Having people take my work up gets me excited. Having you having interest in this particular topic is fantastic. It's a way for me and my colleagues to reach out to a new group of people to understand the kinds of challenges we might have. And the good news, if there is good news, but there always is good news, the good news in particularly in climate change is we have a pretty good idea of what's coming at us over the next several decades. And this gives us an opportunity to make sure that the next few decades are going to be decades we're going to be happy we've done as much as we've done. That we're not going to think back and think, boy, I should have done more. But we've got the information. We can take action. And we can make a difference.
Give me a couple more examples of that. I mean, one thing you gave away, I think, a few minutes ago was that one step is really voting. And that is to recognize that this is a serious issue and try to have elected leaders that share your concern. What else might there be, you know, for individuals or businesses or institutions that if you're going to be encouraging them to take that step forward, again, beyond just voting for leadership, any other examples you can think of?
There's lots of easy examples. Thinking about energy efficiency. When you're energy efficient, you save yourself money. You also save greenhouse gas emissions. Mm-hmm. Just think about sustainability. There's lots of very high levels of interest, particularly on student campuses, about the amount of plastic garbage that's going into our oceans. Do you need to have a plastic bag? Can you use a paper bag instead? We every day make pretty simple decisions. And as you articulated very well a few minutes ago, each one of those then compounds until there is a big impact, even from small shifts by each one of us as individuals.
Well, I really want to thank you for explaining this and for your own commitment and what you're doing to spread the word and get other people enthusiastic to get them to step up as well. And if people would like to know more of what you've been involved with, are there websites or other spots that you would point people to get more information?
There's two recommendations. They can go at the University of Washington, the Center for Health and the Global Environment, and we've got information posted there. If you'd like to know more about the health risks of a changing climate or the risks to agriculture or to other sectors, I would suggest going to look at the National Climate Assessment. And it has chapters on all of the major sectors. It also has chapters on all the different regions. So you can look at what the risks are in your particular region. And there's ways that you can engage with that material and ask questions if there's more that you'd like to find out.
Now, did you say the National Climate Assessment?
It's a National Climate Assessment. It's led by the U.S. Global Change Research Program.
Okay.
And so that has quite a lot of information. And if you'd like to get much more technical, the National Academies of Sciences has quite a large number of reports on different aspects of risks of a changing climate.
Well, I tell you what, it's nice to have a conversation with really one of our leaders in global climate change issues. And I appreciate Dr. Christy Ebi from the University of Washington. Thanks for being on Farm to Table Talk and having this conversation with us.
I just wanted to thank you very much. I really appreciate the opportunity. I appreciate you asking. I appreciate people listening and happy to answer questions if there's more follow-up.
You've been listening to Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson. If you like what you hear, go to farmtotabletalk.com and follow us on Facebook and Twitter, or go to iTunes to subscribe and give us a review and a rating. Thanks for listening to Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson.